Buddhism is a tradition that is very rich in training the mind, showing us how to perceive reality, how to develop our own inner good qualities. Buddhism is not so much a religion as it is a system of mental training and a way of living our life. So within Buddhism, there's a very systematic way that's spelled out really clearly on how to develop love and compassion and altruism. And these things all have very specific definitions and meanings within Buddhism. And these definitions are often quite different than how we use the words in our ordinary English language and the implications that they have. So the systematic process of training the mind involves using reason and analysis and investigation. It also involves concentration, and it especially involves our heart. In other words, there is not a split between intellect and the heart, or at least there shouldn't be in our development. In other words, the more we use reasoning, the more it affects our heart and really transforms us and helps us to generate positive emotions. And the more our heart opens, the more we have deep feelings of compassion or trust and so on, then that fertilizes the mind of reasoning and understanding so that that mind can understand things at a much deeper level. So these two things, reasoning and heart, they complement each other, or reasoning and confidence or faith, however you want to call them. They help each other on the path. And the kind of reasoning we're using is not just some kind of dry intellectual blah blah. It's trying to look at our own preconceptions in our mind, recognizing our own thought patterns, and then really questioning ourselves whether our thought patterns and our instinctual assumptions are actually realistic, if they're correct, and second of all, if they're beneficial. And so it's a very deep kind of questioning and investigation and reasoning. It's not an intellectual thing. So within this, there are two types of meditation. One is stabilizing meditation that's principally designed to help us develop concentration. In other words, to be able to fix the mind single-pointedly on whatever object we want to concentrate on so that we can really get into it without so much distraction. And then the second kind of meditation is analytic meditation, where we're really thinking and investigating. And although the initial forms of the analytic meditation seem to involve a lot of conceptualization and thought, as we go deeper and deeper, this meditation actually transcends concept and thought. But that's quite far away along the path. So the path is something that definitely takes time. It's a system of mental training. It's not going to happen quickly. It's not sufficient just to understand the principles intellectually, because what we're really working with is our habitual tendencies and impulses, and we really need to look at those closely and work with them over a period of time, constantly being mindful and aware of what they are, being mindful and aware of our aspiration and our potential and how we can be, and then constantly retraining or reforming our mind so that it corresponds more with reality and corresponds more with what is beneficial to others. So this process of developing love and compassion begins first with understanding our own situation, because before we can care about others and understand their situation, we have to understand our own, because our situations are all basically the same. And so for this, the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, or more accurately, the Four Facts Seen as True by the Noble Ones. And so this is asking us to look honestly at our own situation. First of all, the fact that we have undesirable experiences in our life. We get born and age and get sick and die, all without choice. We try to prevent problems, but they come to us anyway. We try and get happiness, and it eludes us. Or we get some kind of happiness, and then it doesn't last long, and we wind up dissatisfied again. So we have these undesirable experiences. And second of all, these experiences have causes. And the causes, from a Buddhist viewpoint, are internal ones. These are the deep causes. Of course, there are circumstantial conditions in the environment that we encounter outside of us. But the deep-rooted causes are our own attitudes. Chiefly the one of ignorance, in which we misconceive the nature of reality. Essentially, we make everything very solid. We project a solidity, an entityness, an independence upon both ourself and all others and all phenomena. And so this is a fundamental ignorance that doesn't understand how things are impermanent, how they are dependent, how they arise depending on parts and conditions, and even on our mind and the terms that we use to label them. This ignorance gives rise to attachment, in which we exaggerate or project the good qualities of something or someone, and then want to cling on to it and hold on to it, feeling I can't live without this. And then the ignorance also gives rise to anger or hatred, in which we exaggerate or project negative qualities onto someone or something, and then want to either run away from it or destroy it. So these three, the ignorance, attachment, and anger, cause all of our undesirable experiences at a very, very basic level. So those are the first two noble truths, which are actually the ones that we want to eliminate. And the last two noble truths show our potential and our possibility for eliminating them. So the third noble truth talks about the stopping or the ending of the undesirable experiences and their causes. And what this is getting down to is that we have a fundamental innate goodness. We have a potential in our mind. The basic nature of our mind is not ignorance. It's not misconception. It's not anger and attachment. These things are like fleeting clouds that cover the sky-like nature of our mind. So just as the clouds are not the nature of the sky, they can be removed and we have the clear, pure sky, so too these disturbing attitudes of ignorance, anger, and attachment are not our basic nature. They can't, because they're dependent on misconception, they can be eliminated. They leave, when they're eliminated, what's left is the clear, shining purity of the mind. And then the fourth noble truth is that there's a path to this stoppage. There's a path to actualize our Buddha potential, to get to this pure nature of the mind. And that path is one of following ethics, which means of avoiding the intention to harm others, practicing concentration, in other words, developing mental stability and the ability to focus the mind, and developing wisdom, which enables us to understand the nature of reality. And all of this, from a Mahayana Buddhist point of view, is underlain by altruism. And altruism is the wish to develop ourselves to our fullest potential, to completely purify our mind stream of all defilements, to completely develop all of our good qualities for the purpose of benefiting others. Okay? So that motivation is a very, very important one. And altruism is an attitude. It shows itself in actions, but when we talk of the altruistic intention, we're talking of a mental state that cannot necessarily be seen by other people. Now, to develop this altruism, there's a whole step-by-step process that we have to go through. And it begins by developing some kind of equanimity to all beings. Because one of the difficulties we have is that we are very attached and we cling on to, and we have all sorts of hopes and expectations and clinging for the people that are our friends and relatives. And then on the other hand, we have anger and aversion, resentment, dislike for the people that we feel threatened by or who criticize us or who have different values than us. And then towards the third group of people, strangers, we generally feel apathetic. We almost don't even recognize their humanity and their suffering and their happiness. We just kind of tune them out because there's so many of them. So before we can really develop love, which wants others to be happy, and compassion, which wants them to be free of all suffering, we have to free ourselves from this prejudice and bias of the attachment to friends, aversion towards people that we don't get on with, and apathy towards the strangers. And one way to do this is to really spend some time and see how we categorize these people into three categories: friend, stranger, and disagreeable person, based on how they act towards us. So if they're nice to us, then they're a good person. If they're nice to our enemy, then they're not. Okay. If they criticize us, then they're a horrible person. If they criticize somebody else who we don't like, then they're very intelligent and clever. Okay. And so we basically discriminate people on the basis of how they relate to us. And we don't realize we're doing this. We instead think that we're seeing them as objective entities. But in actual fact, every person has some good qualities. Every person has some bad qualities. It's a completely subjective and very, very biased vision to simply categorize somebody based on how they treat us. So if we recognize that all beings have good qualities, all beings have some difficulties, and not just judge them and evaluate them on how they treat us, then that enables us to free ourselves from the attachment, the anger, and the aversion, and the apathy. And we come to have some kind of open-hearted caring for all beings, because we realize that all beings at some time or another have been strangers to us. Once having been strangers, then they become friends, and some become people we don't like. Then some of our friends go back and become strangers again, and some of our dearest friends become people we don't get along with after a while. And then similarly, some of the people we feel threatened by, we meet them in a different situation, and we become very close friends and trust each other a lot. And similarly, some of those people we don't get along with, we eventually lose touch with them, and they become strangers. So these three categories of friend, enemy, and stranger are completely unreliable. They are not permanent and fixed. And so it's very unfair for us to categorize people in a strict way, thinking that this person is always a good person, I need to cling on to them for my happiness. This person is always an idiot, I need to harm them and get away from them. And this person is always a stranger, so who cares, because I have too much else on my mind to think about. Okay. So these are two ways that we develop equanimity. First of all, by saying that the categorization is based completely on our own prejudiced mind, assuming that we're the center of the universe, and how somebody treats us determines what kind of character they have. And secondly, by recognizing that these three categories, the people in them change constantly. And so there's no sense in getting fixated on somebody with attachment, aversion, or apathy, because in the very next moment, the situation could change and we could relate to them in a totally different way. So this equanimity towards others is freedom from the attachment, anger, and apathy, but it is not indifference towards others. It is not uninvolvement. Instead, it's a very open-hearted concern and feeling of being interrelated and connected with others. On this basis of equanimity, the next thing we think about is equalizing ourselves with others. In other words, recognizing that all beings want happiness and want to avoid suffering equally. Friends, strangers, people we don't get along with, and also ourself. There's absolutely no difference at all in terms of the strength of our wish for happiness, the strength that we wish to be free of suffering. And so therefore, being unequal in our feelings for whose happiness we work for is actually quite unrealistic, because everybody is exactly the same. So that equanimity is quite easy, or that equalizing of self and others is actually quite easy to understand. We all know everybody wants happiness and wants to avoid pain, but we really need to let that fact sink into our mind, so that every time we look at somebody, instead of evaluating them, oh, they look nice, they're intelligent, they're rich, they're poor, they're bugging me, you know, instead of these superficial evaluations and judgments, we start looking into their heart and recognizing that they are exactly like us in wanting happiness and not wanting pain. The next step is to go on and really think of the kindness of others. And I will lead a meditation about this that will be on the other side of the tape. But basically here, what we really spend some time thinking about is not only the kindness of our friends, which is very easy to recognize, but the kindness of strangers, all the people who do the various functions in society that we benefit from, the people who build the roads and so forth. So many people we don't know, but we benefit from their actions. And the kindness of even the people who harm us, because they challenge us to grow in a way that we never would have grown before. So even though they may not have had the intention to be kind to us, still we have received benefit even from the people who challenge us and threaten us. And I think here too, especially for Westerners, it's essentially crucial for us to think about the kindness of our family, because we are too much used to in our culture picking out the few things that went wrong in our childhood and neglecting to focus on everything that went right. And the actual fact of the matter is that without the kindness of others, we would not have lived to adulthood, because as infants we couldn't take care of ourselves. And so for years we had people taking care of us, in addition to giving us an education and so on. And I think it's so important that we really think deeply about this and open our hearts to the kindness we receive from our family and our relatives. That's not to ignore whatever trauma or abuse may have happened in the family, but simply to balance out the perspective, so that we get over our cultural affliction of seeing childhood as a disease you have to recover from. You know, we should see childhood is actually, you know, something where we did receive a lot of kindness from others. So as we meditate on the kindness of others, what happens is we stop feeling alienated and disconnected, and we instead come to recognize that in actual fact we have been the recipient of a tremendous amount of help and benefit from others. And to allow ourselves to actually experience being the recipient of benefit, instead of our too common way of building up walls because we think that people don't care enough for us, or they're cruel, or they're selfish, but to really open our hearts to see what we have received and to feel a sense of gratitude and interconnectedness with others.